Hello and welcome to the next episode of Research VR, where we dig deep beyond the realms of virtual reality. Today is a historical moment. As you know, our podcast exists since 1 year and 2 months, maybe slightly later, and since roughly week two of this podcast, we have been trying to guest one special guest, that is Thomas Bedenk. Hello, Thomas.
Hello.
We are obviously here with Chris and me. Hi, Chris.
Hi.
But we have also two star guests, because after that long time, I couldn't bear just having Thomas here. So we have another Thomas, Thomas Schuler.
Hello. Thomas.
You know him from the episode about the medical VR we did long time ago. But we also have another star guest, Mr. Igor Sauer. Hello.
Hello.
And before we go into the discussion of the medical topics and all the exciting things VR gives us, and also, as you might hear again, we are at the CeBIT 2017, right, in the hall, so sorry for the noise behind us. Maybe our guest can quickly introduce himself, and let's start from the vice versa with Igor Sauer.
Okay, well, yeah, thank you for having me here. I'm Igor Sauer. I'm a surgeon at the Charité Universitätsmedizin Berlin. And I'm head of research, surgical research, experimental research in Berlin as well. And we mainly deal with biotechnology in the field of surgery. So our main focus is on generating new organs, bioartificial organs, artificial organs. We try on new things in dealing with cancer, liver cancer, intestinal cancer. I don't know if it was 1.5 years ago, we got in touch with several companies, among these Microsoft, and got to know technology for mixed reality, and we were quite surprised how far they got already. And we started in testing these devices in our surgical field as well.
Thomas?
Which Thomas?
Thomas Schuler. Right?
Okay, thanks for having me again. I introduced myself already in the past episode, so we keep it short. I'm a software developer at Salt and Pepper Software in Osnabrück.
The division Virtual Spice.
Yes, we have the division Virtual Spice, which I started, which I founded, and where we have now a team of developers working on virtual reality applications. So we build products around engineering use cases, but also around therapeutical and medical use cases. So I'm glad to be again on this podcast, and I'm looking forward for the discussion.
Okay. The other Thomas.
Yeah, I'm the other Thomas. Thomas Bedenk. I study design and human factors, which has a little more of the psychological background of that. And for 10 years, I did freelance software development and some movie post-production. And then for another 7 years, I had a game studio. And now I'm a virtual reality consultant, and I'm leading the virtual reality department in Exit, which is a Berlin digital agency that helps for digital transformation. And personally, I'm leading the department for VR AR efforts, and speaking at conferences and trying to connect. And my personal approach to all these topics, first of all, personally, I had a background. I programmed before, I did design before, I visual and conceptual design, I did management. So I kind of had a look into all the different departments that you need for game development. Mm-hmm. And then I also created games. So I think it's very important to look at these new technologies from an interdisciplinary mm-hmm. perspective, mm-hmm. and have some little research background from my master's and stuff like that. So I think while there's a lot of stuff that needs to be iteratively approached, like we do in games to flesh out user experience and things like mm-hmm. that, there's already a lot of knowledge out there as well about VR research, about user interaction research. And I think it is a little bit, it could be used more in the community. And so I'm trying to bring together all those different aspects mm-hmm. and try to have a practical approach. And at ExitSet, we do a lot of prototyping. We call this format creative prototyping, just to give you an idea of what we do there at ExitSet. And that format has four of our experts, for example, VR developers, VR designers. And then we invite, let's say, two domain specialists from our client. Mm-hmm. It could be Volkswagen, for example, where we did this format with. And together as an interdisciplinary team, we try to use agile methods, fast development cycles, stakeholders join every 2 weeks and redefine what's mm-hmm. the target of this. And by that, especially with big corporations where you have a hard time establishing scenarios like mm-hmm. that helps a lot to have a really fast approach and see where this is actually useful for the mm-hmm. company and the use case. Mm-hmm. And that's just an example of how you can bring all these things together.
That's really impressive. Now, one might wonder why we brought all you together. And I think the little secret, and I'm not sure if you are willing or allowed to speak about the little secret, is that secretly you all know each other that I didn't know, right? So yeah, what's the story behind it?
Well, maybe the linking point is a friend of mine, of ours maybe, in Berlin, who invited me to be on board of a project ongoing between Humboldt University and Charité. And the idea is to use augmented reality technologies for augmenting the operation process of surgeons, for example, during liver
surgery.
Okay.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean resection. I think this is the resection, term you like so much.
Yeah. Right. So yeah, that was the reason why I came in touch with Igor, and then my friend Moritz Geisner. Also brought on the name Thomas Bedenk, and it was very interesting to see that you were looking to bring us together. So it's a very nice moment to sit together and discuss what we can do with this technology for medical purposes. Mm-hmm. Of course, we have been discussing also other areas of application, but I think the medical area of application is really interesting. And what I learned during this first kickoff meeting that we had is that since we all know augmented reality technologies are still a bit limited in what they can show, the field of view is pretty limited. I had the impression that actually the area of application of surgery is pretty, it aligns very much because the operating field is also usually pretty small. So you can actually augment that situation very good with these technologies.
Mm-hmm. And what's the motivation for the universities to participate?
Well, I mean, surgery is, of course, very image-based. Mm-hmm. Whatever we do, we plan beforehand based on MRI scans, on computer tomography, CT scans. And what we usually do is we browse through these different layers of these images. And with the help of the radiologist, we imagine, we build up a three-dimensional model in our head. And this is necessary beforehand in order to decide whether we perform surgery, first of all, and if we do so, what kind of surgery do we do? You mm-hmm. know, how extended will be the resection? Resection means removing a certain part of the liver, for example, or any other organ. We have chosen the liver as a kind of a role model mm-hmm. because it is basically a huge network of vessels and bile ducts, and in between you have these liver cells. And if you, whenever you perform liver surgery, you somehow have to go through this very soft tissue, and you will always be faced with vessels you have to control. You have mm-hmm. to dissect them, separate them, and ligate or clip them, and you need to know where are the vessels mm-hmm. beforehand and during surgery in order to define where you perform this resection. And especially during surgery, you need to know when larger vessels will arrive. And this would help you in performing this kind of procedure. Mm-hmm. And therefore, it's quite obvious that we would love to have the three-dimensional images right during surgery in the OR.
Mm-hmm. Now, you, Thomas Bedenk, give a lot of talks and you come a lot around. How would you view, in context of this whole VR IR movement, the initiative that we are just discussing? So, is there something super, super unique, or are there many people, maybe not on specifically on the liver, but in general, trying to implement those technologies in this context?
So, augmented reality has a pretty long history of being used in medical scenarios. That's not completely new, but we also see that with virtual reality in other domains. The key change that happened in the last years is the affordability of all the hardware,
yeah.
but at the same time raising the quality by magnitudes. And the portability of something like a HoloLens that that makes it super easy to use something like that in surgery right now without even having it certified and things like that is a key to have a lot more direct and approach to it and try out things mm-hmm. where usually the domain was very, very research heavy and long periods of time to even get something through certification, things like that.
Yeah.
So one thing I wanted to mention about you saying the limited field of view, absolutely right. That's a great match for surgery because it's also very focused and on the spot. But one huge handicap we have from what you described is that, and that's generally a limitation augmented reality has right now, is the missing contextualization and object tracking. And there are object tracking technologies. We just looked at something very interesting today at ExitSet where it's mesh-based tracking, but it's still not animated tracking. And then you brought up the example of face tracking movies. So the key question here to make it even more usable, and we just discussed that on a panel, and is how can we track the liver during surgery to then augment it, that living organ? And that's that's really a challenging question that hasn't been already solved, and it's I think that's pretty cutting edge at the kind of research that's being done right now,
yeah.
but also the practical approach to just trying it out.
Yeah, so just to add, when you perform surgery and visceral organs, of course, these organs, they move, they are soft, they move, the patient breathes, and this means continuously moving organs, plus you manipulate them. So you grab them, you have to move them in order to perform surgery, basically.
Yeah.
And therefore, it's rather complex in terms of scanning the surgical site.
And you also need to keep in mind that while moving them, also the inner structure will change,
sure.
and some tissues might react differently to
completely.
Forces and others again.
Yeah, this is a very intra-individual problem because, for example, the liver again, it's again a nice example. If you have liver cirrhosis, the liver tissue is rather stiff. If it's a nice young liver, of course, it's soft and flexible. And in terms of mixing reality and virtual objects, of course, you would have to know how stiff is the material.
Definitely. Yeah. Another topic would be maybe regulations. So
before we go to regulations, I would like to continue talking about the augmented reality and the liver.
Mm-hmm.
What sort of information would you already have in the HoloLens? So you said that you use the scans at first to plan the operation. What sort of information do you already have in the scans? What sort of information can you get out of scans? Like, can you get the vessels, the
yes.
position of vessels?
Well, this is the main information we use at the mm-hmm. moment. So what we do is we have these MRI, or in this case better, the CT scans with certain contrast media, and therefore we are able to have a three-dimensional model of
mm-hmm.
the vessels inside the liver. And the liver has the arteries, the liver has mm-hmm. a so-called portal vein
mm-hmm.
that drains the blood from the mm-hmm. intestine through the liver, and we have the veins that transports the blood back to the heart.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, we do have bile ducts. So we have basically four main vessel structures
mm-hmm.
that we have to think of constantly when performing surgery.
Mm-hmm.
And what we do at the moment is we have this three-dimensional model. Of course, you have almost unlimited branches. We do this until the fourth or fifth branch.
Mm-hmm.
And then we can position this model right above the surgical site. So when you perform surgery, of course, you don't have this three-dimensional model right in the surgical site, but
mm-hmm.
a little bit above. And if you want to be reassured about the anatomy, you just have to look up a bit and
mm-hmm.
can have a look at the three-dimensional model.
Right now you have it as a desktop, right? Like you have a monitor and this 3D
no.
model.
Oh, no.
It's already in HoloLens.
This is already what we just discussed was already the situation we have in VR.
Igor, let me ask you just because we just had that topic and it was great that we showed the video.
Yeah.
Is that video of what you just described, is it somewhere online available? Or
not
can
yet.
We make it available?
Well, we will have a publication on this topic and I'd like to link it to this publication, but then it will be definitely online.
Maybe a simple, stupid question. Why would you do a liver operation? So what are the reasons for it?
Oh.
I never had one and I hope I will never need one.
Some people drink alcohol.
Oh, that's clear. Okay, yeah.
And you might get cirrhosis. And if you get cirrhosis, you might get a liver tumor. This is, for example, a reason. So, no, the liver is a major organ inside the body. And it has a very central role in all metabolic functions of the human being. A lot of stuff is synthesized, produced in the liver, coagulation factors, proteins, etc., etc. So it's a very central organ. Plus, or because it's so central, the bloodstream of the intestine it is drained through the liver. So the liver is perfused with almost 3 liters per minute.
Whoa.
And therefore, whenever you have a tumor somewhere in the intestine, for example, you might have some kind of metastasis inside the liver as well. So there are either tumors that are of hepatic origin, of liver origin, or there might be metastasis from the intestine, for example. And whenever you have this, surgery is necessary in order to remove this tumor mass. And this is the main reason why we operate on the liver, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Just a very quick note. And what's also standing out is that you're already using the HoloLens with that projection that you just described on real surgeries on human beings.
Okay.
So that's already being used.
Of course, it's a test setup.
Test setup, and you're asking them to do it. It's not general. Say how your department is called, just to do. It's experimental.
Well, no, our department is the Department of Surgery at the Charité, but within the Department of Surgery, we have the so-called experimental surgery.
Yeah.
And this is where we deal with all these biotechnology approaches.
That sounds dangerous.
It's not. I know.
Oh my gosh, I'm already getting goosebumps from all the talk about tumors and stuff, and now experimental one. Yeah, Thomas.
Yeah, I would like one time to come back to the problem of registering the real environment of kind of having some kind of calculation, some kind of algorithm that is able to figure out where is the liver in the real world to be able to augment it. And I think that was also something that popped out during the first kickoff. When you see a video of that surgery, okay, you see the organ moving around a lot, but you also see that it's actually pretty nicely shaped. So you can pretty well, just by image recognition, already figure out where the boundaries are, because of I think you do the surgery itself, the cutting you do
ultrasound or it's a certain device where the tip is moving by ultrasound, driven by ultrasound, and this is kind of disrupting this soft liver tissue, the liver cells, the hepatocytes. And survives are the vessels and the bile ducts, these small vessels and bile ducts, and you have to go step by step and ligate and clip these vessels.
And they leave a really nice white mark on the red liver tissue. So so that makes it pretty easy to figure that out. You can do a boundary recognition, image recognition on it. You could also even leave marks on the liver at certain spots that you then figure out. So I think it's not only that this field of view is perfect for the technology currently, but also the problem that we of course have with augmented reality to understand the reality. Is in this scenario it's possible to do because it is
a pretty controlled environment. I think that's what you're getting at. But then the liver itself is very individual, and then but we have that from the MRI scan or for the CT scan. Mm-hmm. And but what you're saying, and I think we're thinking about the same thing, is like if you have the markup line, you kind of know. And there is before the surgery, there's actually the surgical planning where you decide on a cutting plane through the organ, so you already know prior surgery where this plane is going through the 3D mesh kind of. when you're now knowing the line where you're going to cut, you kind of know the plane where it's going through. You can do the image recognition on those lines when they're separating, and then you can kind of, by the vessels that you found and by also by the size of the opening, you kind of can estimate how far you've gone through the organ, and then you could warn there is another vessel coming up, be careful, and by that be more efficient until you get there. So the image recognition, I think, is doable because it is a very specific information that you want, and if you have the scan and all that, it is a pretty controlled environment, but it's still not super easy.
No, it's not super easy, but that was exactly what I was aiming at. So yeah, right, it's not super easy, and then also, and that's what's very interesting also, I think, to research on is how does the operating process of the surgeon and also the planning of the surgeon, the cognitive model of the surgeon, changes when you have that information in hand. So how much do you rely then on that visual extra information? And that's then the question, how close to reality it has to be, right? So that's, I think, also very interesting to figure out. So I think this area of application is something where we could go that step further and to see how it really works in everyday life. Mm-hmm. But there are, of course, a couple of questions still open to be answered.
What I like in that context, and I'm just throwing it in because I think it's another close field to discuss, is that you're also looking at remote and telemedicine and things like that. And what we just created a demo of connecting a virtual reality space. Mm-hmm. You can find it online. Maybe you can share the link or something. Where we connected a virtual reality space with HoloLens, and it's networked. And you see in virtual reality, you see the stream of the. This is not a medical application, just an example. Yeah. You see the video stream of the HoloLens in virtual reality, so the operator knows exactly what the other one sees. Then you have a virtual version of the real object the HoloLens operator is standing in front of. You can mark something up, and the other person sees it marked up right on the real object. And you could transfer that same kind of model onto this application, and then for doing the surgery, you're still limited with the interaction you can do with the HoloLens, you know, because you don't want to. It's pretty imprecise to do those clicking around in air, and then an operator could. You already have assistants in the surgery room, but there could be another assistant that kind of controls the virtual environment, the augmentation, and helps you along this process by highlighting stuff on the model directly and things like that. So I think that's also a very interesting scenario where it's not just dependent on image recognition, but that could also improve a surgical scenario like that.
Yeah. So, well, I'm not a big fan of Microsoft, but I have to admit that the HoloLens is quite advanced, and they have built-in Skype solutions already, and this is something we tried out as well, and actually this works quite well as well. You are able to transmit the image the surgeon sees to a remote tablet computer, for example. And what they even implemented is that you can mark certain structures via a pen and this tablet computer from remote right into the surgical site. Of course, this doesn't use this kind of three-dimensional potential, but you know, your approach with the HTC Vive, for example, as a remote player, of course, would enable this. And this is very helpful as well, because we quite often have the situation that we have to help out other hospitals in complicated surgical cases, and it would be nice to have this kind of over-the-shoulder look to the surgeon from remote as well. Or if you think about certain situations during the night, you know, we could ask our chief, Professor Prachka, can you have a look right from your bed into the surgical site and give us advice?
But then if I'm doing this in virtual reality and I would have already a scan of the liver, maybe even in the context already still in the human, then I could increase the image and have a little more details or just analyze a certain region, right? I would not be limited by the one-to-one size.
Well, you know, you mentioned virtual reality. I don't see virtual reality in the OR.
I mean, in this particular context, in the application
scenario.
Yeah.
But then, I think you know a lot better. But the CT scan can only tell you so much about what you actually have in front of your face.
Well, I mean, with this tele-mentoring or tele-coaching approach, I mean, you would basically transmit the actual image from the surgical side.
Unless you already have a super accurate live 3D scan of the organ, that would be even better.
Okay, yeah, well, maybe. Yeah, sure.
I think there are three elephants in the room. One is very big, and that's what we are discussing right now, the technical limitations. Okay, CT scans won't get way better, but HoloLens will. So what I find quite interesting is that the HoloLens seems to be already good enough, and it's just a prototype in the end. Yeah, it will get way better. Yeah. The second elephant, I think, is, well, if we start to use those technologies to help the doctor, I don't like to use buzzwords, but artificial intelligence, just say that, you could like train a system, a classifier, to figure out how the liver moves to help the doctor, but long term the system could technically also operate the liver itself. And before we come to the third elephant, I would like to focus on the second one.
Well, yeah, I mean, this was brought up by Thomas Bedenk earlier as well in this panel discussion. Of course, you know, I can see that artificial intelligence will help as well, and I can see that even, you know, going further, combined with robotic surgery, you know, that an additional step will be that the robot, who is at the moment basically a joystick-operated minimal invasive surgical instrument, could start to do certain surgical procedures autonomously. Because when you think of liver surgery again, of course, this software would be fed with all the information from the actual CT scan, would perfectly know where are the vessels, could preload certain clips in a certain size, and maybe even faster and more accurate in doing this kind of procedure. Yeah,
at least long term, right?
Yeah.
What do you think?
I mean, I brought up the same thing, but I don't think we have the similar audiences, so I'm just going to say it again, that there has been research already on CT scans for where the AI was better than
classifying cancer, right?
Yeah, I think that's what it was. Classifying cancer on scans, where the AI was better than human beings, and I think it is already used as its assistance, but it's not taking over yet. But okay, we're not that far from a scenario like that.
One fact, my uncle is working with tissues from cancer and has to analyze it. And he like once showed me a study where they trained pigeons to pick the point that is cancerous. And apparently pigeons are super good at it.
Well, how well
I don't know.
Constructed was that study?
I wonder. On the actual tissue sample or on a picture?
On the picture.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. <I'm glad. laughs>
Experimental surgery.
Well, I mean, if you imagine a flying HoloLens with a knife on it and it's cutting yourself, you can also imagine a pigeon actually trying to pick at your
head. I only heard pigeons with HoloLenses.
Okay. Now, maybe the third and maybe the most unpredictable or the most disappointing and sad reality elephant is regulations, right? Mm-hmm. So I know that you, Thomas, Thomas Schüler had actually some kind of startup that was going in the directions of medical, so you faced the regulations. I'm pretty sure that Thomas Bedenk also knows something or experienced the regulations, and obviously coming from the science, you are faced with regulations every day, whether it's ethical regulations, whether it's regulations from the government or whatsoever. So how much are the regulations in the way of innovation, especially in the medical AR/VR field, and how soon do you expect them, you know, to change, or is there like a will?
And how much do they help?
Yeah, exactly.
First of all, we have to distinguish between whether the actual innovation that is being done is something as invasive as, for example, liver surgery is, or whether it's actually something, some adjunct therapy for something. I believe regulations are pretty important for especially this type of invasive surgery, where you need these regulations to at least know where you need, kind of what boundaries you have to reach, and how your innovation needs to be done, to be performed in order to be actually successful in everyday life. And I think that's also a point that I want to bring back again to the table is, though it's a research VR podcast, I think what we actually aim at in this round over here is to see these augmented reality and virtual reality technologies being applied in everyday life, yeah. Right? So it's not only to make a research point, to make a nice prototype, but we really want to have that application everyday life.
Yep.
And I mean, I think the regulations, especially in the invasive surgery area, they really help you to figure out what is the kind of minimum viable product that you can bring to the table that already has a added value. So I think maybe in this area it's really positive to have some boundary conditions that you need to be able to adapt to.
I think there's absolute value in regulations in health, absolutely, but at
deep
the same
state,
time,
it's a deep state. It's trying to control us.
At the same time, there is definitely protectionism and lobbyism. If it's in education, if it's in health, there are established companies, there are established things that they want to keep going the way that I don't want to blow that up more than it is. But if especially if you look at that's a little a German topic, but at the public insurances, they cover, I don't know how you pronounce it, homeopathic things, and almost every public insurance covers that now, like pays for it. And when scientifically looking at it, yeah, they're paying for it. And scientifically looking at it,
they are,
there is no effect of it because there is just maybe one molecule of whatever ingredient is still left in those sugar pills. It's already too much. So if you look at something like that being paid for without the customer having paid for it, and then having something that's really helpful, let's say in therapy, and then the not being paid for regulation reasons, then I think that's a little over-regulated, or regulated in the wrong way.
But is this what you meant with regulation? We of course, this is in a very early stage, and we think about regulation, but I think it's far too early to discuss this. But if you think of regulations in radiology, for example, when you look at CT scans, if you do it professionally, you need certain screens, you need a certain room, ambient light, etc., in order to use these 2D pictures for diagnostics. And of course, this would be something that should apply to these devices as well. However, I think when it comes to this step, there will be a new category for devices. You know, it's the same what we have in biotechnology. There were medical technology like a dialysis machine, and then there were for example, pills, drugs, and then all of a sudden we had these new approaches of tissue and engineered of bioartificial organs. So, for example, we developed a bioartificial liver. This is part an artificial tubings, hollow fibers, etc. But in part, it's human cells. So, what is it? Is it a transplant? Is it a dialysis machine? At the beginning, they said it's a pill, basically, because they said, well, you have to use all the laws we have for medicinal for drugs, and therefore, for example, we had to test it, these devices on certain machines in order to simulate transport of them, in order to show that the ingredients of our pill, this bioartificial liver, are still the same after transporting it for a few hundred kilometers. So nowadays we have different law. There are new regulations for these new devices, and I guess this is something that will happen in this case as well.
Yeah, I think it's just a matter of if it's holding us back right now. But I think you're right. Even the discussion, it's probably more interesting this discussing the cool AR, VR stuff than the regulations.
And I have one question again to Igor, because you said you used the HoloLens already during surgery, and you said you like it, it's good, it's helpful. But maybe just one very basic question towards the usability of the head-mounted display that you have. So, is that really, isn't it in the way? Is the field of view, does it really cover some places that you would like to see, look at, or
Well, you know, we haven't equipped the first surgeon so far. We always took the first assistant to use the device, and for security reasons, of course. And it's amazingly non-disturbing. Of course, you know, we haven't we weren't wearing it for several hours. We would just put it on when it's usable, when it's necessary, or when it's, you know, when we actually do the livery section.
How do you sterilize it?
Well, it's not sterilized. You know, your eyes are not sterile either. You know, you're usually sterile in the OR, you know, from your nipples down to your belly button, basically.
Okay.
Yeah.
No.
This is the sterile field. And of course, your hands, your arms are sterile. You know, above, you know, your head, you have your face mask. Of course, this is not sterile. Your eyes are not sterile, your head is not sterile. Okay. And therefore, you know, you don't need a sterile HoloLens.
You just can't touch it.
Yeah, you can't touch it. No. But again, you know, you don't need to touch it because, you know, you can use the HoloLens and use your voice commands, you can use your hands. And this works fine. You know, this works fine, very fine in this complex surgical OR with all these machines. You have metal walls, glass walls, etc. A lot of light. You know, this was my first concern, that you won't see the hologram in this bright light in the OR. But
yeah.
Somehow it works quite well.
Igor, I have a very trivial off-topic question, kind of, because you just not touching the HoloLens, and I mean, we all have our habits. Do you, as a surgeon, do you actually have to go through like a training or habit training not to scratch your face while in surgery or something like that, or are you just doing it? Or
no, but you can't.
Yeah, you just can't. And that's
why you can
ask someone.
Yeah, no, you can ask someone. You can ask the nurse if you want to. Or you could.
And then
scratch.
The nurse is used up. She can't touch anything either. Well,
yeah, you can scratch. I mean, you can scratch your head on the shoulder of your colleague, for example. That's what you do. But you have to be careful. I mean.
Okay,
that's very intimate.
or do you have this like scratching instrument?
No,
sterilized.
No.
Could have a small drone flying around.
You don't scratch, basically.
Yeah, okay. You just don't scratch. Oh,
just because this is like a pretty subconscious behavior. That's why I'm wondering if you have to train.
But this
not
is something
to
you
do.
Have to learn. Yeah. I mean, sometimes there's maybe a medical student and he might do something like this, and then of course
I would definitely
he will
do
be
that
so ashamed
time.
Forever.
There's
he
someone with the ruler. Kind of.
Yeah. Now, of course, you have to
electroshocks everyone every time you get scratched.
Pavlov learning.
Okay. That's interesting. This kind of question. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a very practical thing.
Yeah, sure.
Now, maybe before we come to a slow end, how do you see the future? Like, all of you, we have different perspectives. Where will the journey go?
How far off the future? Because else we'll land on the Alexa AI doing everything.
I mean, Alexa is super awesome. It would be awesome if you tell your Alexa or your HoloLens, you know, open patient number 440, and it stands 441, and then you have the wrong liver. So, I mean, maybe the next 5 years.
So, actually, I have one step back question that would lead to what you just asked. How flexible is now the medical development?
What do you mean with flexible?
So, I have an idea. And how do I come to the execution of this idea? So, we just had this project, the chronic back pain project. And since it was developed at the company, it was developed maybe a little faster, maybe a little slower. The only perspective I know is the one that we developed. Mm-hmm. So how is it developed by other, maybe university, maybe other companies?
Well, I think at least what I know is that that's maybe a place where regulations are a little bit in the way of adapting to this new type of development approaches, because you also have to have a very certified process how you do that. So the method of developing is very, very, very rigid and certified. And that's an interesting point, because I think from all projects that I've seen so far, in software development and from everything that you can read about it, everyone nowadays knows that agile development processes are the right way to go. You really have to adapt. You have to have a process where you don't know in the beginning exactly where you want to end, and where you also don't document each step, because some of the steps are simply omitted afterwards. They will be turned back. So that's the whole idea of agility: is inspect and adapt often, and try to kind of, in an unforeseeable future, try to find a nice path to a good working project. So I think that's maybe one point where regulations are a bit stiff, because you kind of have to adapt this nice agile process that is really free to be possible to use it in these medical development approaches. So that's my view on it.
I think first of all, I mean, you have to decide. I mean, one way is just doing it, you know, like,
okay.
I mean, unless you're actually applying it and unless you're trying to get it certified for a big audience, and unless you're using a human to do surgery, you can do all kinds of things, you know, but you're not kind of limited to those regulations. You can just try it out. Even if it's like a brown boxing, like just putting card boxes around, you can try a lot of prototyping if you're actually developing a prototype, a full project and a product, then that's a different question.
But if I'm a startup or a company, my end goal is actually get money so that I can do further development, so I can maintain the application, so I can upgrade the application.
You can also get money for prototyping, but of course it's a wide field. You know, we work quite a lot with car manufacturers, and they have very strict regulations on their internal networks, for example. And someone from some car company that I'm not gonna say the name is, they also say, like, you know what, we just set up our own network, don't have high security stuff in there, we just do it, because else it would take us months or weeks to do the same thing. So that's just how much risk do you want to take, how direct is your approach, and how fast do you want to be with finding stuff out. And then of course, it's a whole different story if you want to have a certified medical product on the market. That's a different story.
Well, I think money is the limiting factor at the moment. Of course, I mean, you spoke about startup companies that, of course, have to raise money and have to have a product.
Yep.
Same is basically for the university as well. I mean, at the moment, our limitation, I think, is our funds for these kind of projects. Because, of course, in the field of biotechnology, medical research, we have certain funding bodies. And I think this field is rather new. You know, there are still not certain cores for these kind of projects. But I'm pretty sure they will soon be available, and we will have these cores. And this is why I think it's so important for us as a university to start with these projects, even if we have very limited budget at the moment, because it's just the normal university budget. We don't have any third-party funds for these projects at the moment. And quite interestingly, companies like Microsoft are not willing to invest in these kind of projects. They're rather ask for money in order to develop certain software solutions.
And I mean, the fact that you actually work with the HoloLens shows very nicely that there is prototypical approach also in medical development, right?
So, well, definitely. I mean, you call it agile programming.
Right? Well, yeah.
I mean, this is how research works. I mean, whenever we, every project starts with kind of a pre-testing of a certain idea, and then if this works out, of course we will start with a certain amount of experiments, and therefore, you know, this is the way we work.
And there is some difference, because agility in software development means that after each 3 to 4 weeks phase, you have an increment of a working product that is applied in daily life. So that's, I think, something that you can't directly translate to the medical domain. But you can do it, of course, in all domains where there are no regulations, because people can just go with it. And the interesting idea of it is, of course, because it's applied in everyday life, each increment, you get all the feedback from the users, and that's really important.
Which is true, but you have that challenge. Like I said, I introduced our creative prototyping format, and that's in theory, you could do it everywhere, but practically, you can't do it everywhere because every company is structured different and has a different culture, and you can't just push those things. In fact, I heard a quote before from someone who quoted someone at Siemens, which was like the Betriebsrat, which would be similar to a union thing. And they said, we'll sit through agile development being introduced at Siemens, meaning like, okay, well, we employees have the power not to, to change anything we do right now. So there is quite some resistance in adopting to those methods, and you can't use those methods for everything because there also is a reason why big corporations with 600,000 employees have other structures.
Yeah.
But that's why sometimes you have to externalize those processes, and then you have all the freedom back. But still, it's going to be on a project basis. The key question is, can you convince managers? Can you convince scientists, councils? Can you convince to have a lot more openness in the definition of your project? And I agree, research is done very similar, but the scope of every single approach to a problem is a lot bigger than in rapid prototyping. It's not a matter of a week to figure something out. It's a matter of one study after the other to figure something out.
How do you bring research and innovation together? How do you make startups that think in months?
Research is innovation. Research is innovation.
Okay, I mean, sorry. I agree. Okay, I will rephrase the question because that was a little bit polemic. How do you manage the rather slow and precise pace in science that has the justification that you want to do good science, where you actually do a lot of studies, you evaluate them, you take long time for the paper. It's just a long process, and when you figure something out, it's not necessarily a product. How do you combine the everyday life from science with the everyday life of a startup that, you know, don't sleep 20 hours per day, drink like 16 gallons of coffee, and are thinking in 3 months and millions of investment paces?
Well, you know, I think you can do both in parallel. I mean, this is what we're doing at the moment. I mean, we just use this technology, we test it in a certain environment. We team up with guys like you in order to develop, for example, a certain app, you know, just configured to what we need in the OR. And this, I guess, would be the approach of a small startup company. And therefore, you know, we basically combine these two approaches because, you know, it's easily done as the main part is software. We don't develop any hardware. We have to deal with the use case, we have to deal with the software, and I think this is something you can perfectly do in parallel.
You hear the people clapping
in
the background. Okay. Should we slowly come to an end? I would say so.
It's time.
Yeah. It's already your second kind of panel discussion today, right? So
it's interesting.
No, it's very interesting.
Okay. Maybe I will try again to ask this question, and maybe I will once again not get an answer. What do you see in the future, like hardware-wise, research-wise, medical-wise? How do you see things develop in near future?
Because with respect to AR, VR.
With respect AR, VR, exactly. So that's what we basically talk about. And I mean, I understand that there is this artificial intelligence boom going on with Alexa. There is this IR, VR boom going on that we are speaking all the time around. There is genetic engineering, gen technology, research coming up, new methods. So how to keep up with the pace, and what do you see in a, you know, just take your realist into the forest. Just let's be all optimists and predict the bright futures to work towards.
Well, yeah, I don't know about the future of AI in medicine. Of course, there will be one. But I think we should concentrate on the use of AR and VR.
Yeah.
And I guess this will change the way we perform surgery because you will have these three-dimensional objects quite handy right in the OR, right in the surgical field, and this will of course change the way you perform surgery. And at some point, you know, it might be mandatory to have these images right in the OR in order to guarantee a certain quality.
Okay.
Well, I think any field where the space and three dimension are inherent to what you're doing are massively gonna profit from VR and AR. And that's basically, and I also don't like this competition between AR and VR because there's no point in it. There's just different applications for VR and the different applications for AR. And that's why I think there is a bright future to be this. It's not gonna die down again. We're just at a point where it's massively improved, and we're just gonna keep going because we have massive investments. They're not gonna die down, and we have so many applications for it. I mean, AR, VR, you can come up basically with a new use case every day. And the bigger challenge for ARs, I still see what I mentioned before, in the contextualization and the recognition of objects and making more use out of that combined with artificial intelligence. It's just such an interesting and amazing field to be in right now because there's still so much to be discovered.
So I will keep that shorter. I see virtual reality being applied in everyday life in many different domains within 2 years from now. I believe engineering, education are probably the first sectors to really adapt this technology to their daily processes. But I believe medicine will not take much longer. For augmented reality, I mean, it depends because we don't see that one device really popping out right now. But I feel maybe 5 years from now, we will have really solid use cases that can be actually applied. And maybe in that domain, medicine is actually even the early adopter. Because as we discussed already, the boundary conditions in these OR rooms are pretty well made for augmentation.
Okay, maybe last but not least, small comment from you, Thomas, and we have to very soon end.
Okay.
Because the delegation is coming and we need to talk.
That's cool. Maybe then just as a wrap up, thanks for having us again. And it was a really good discussion. I look forward maybe to be again on this podcast.
Yeah.
Thanks. Probably we'll have some after show party.
I always love to have
this time. We will make it faster again than over a year to actually.
Yeah, well, it's a historical moment. And it proves that if you work long enough on something, it can happen.
Yeah. That's a good
So without further ado, I wish our audience a pleasant listening as usual. Like, share, spread the word, support us by it, and tune out.
And see you next time.
Goodbye.
Bye.